Hello and welcome to the History of the Germans, episode 140, Rudolf von Habsburg and the Golden King, Ottokar II of Bohemia. Now this week we'll look at what poor Count Rudolf of Habsburg does once he had been elected King of the Romans. This is not the first time the electors have chosen a man of much more modest means than themselves. William of Holland and Hermann von Salm had failed to leverage their elevated status into tangible gains. But Rudolf is different. Through a combination of charm, cunning, and fecundity, he managed to wrestle the duchies of Austria, Styria, and Carinthia from its current owner, the immeasurably rich and the profoundly vain King Ottokar II of Bohemia. A story of political acumen, personal bravery, and dishonorable tactics. But before we start, let me thank our patrons one more time. They are the ones who keep this show on the road, and they get mentioned at the start of the podcast. As you may have noticed, I normally just read out the first name and initial, but some have asked to have their full name read out. So I asked the whole patron community how they want me to proceed. That was a genuine question and not just me fishing for compliments, but I must say I'm a little bit overwhelmed by the nice things you guys had to say about the podcast. On the subject itself, it seems that the views are very divided. Some like the anonymized versions, others really want me to read out their full name. So I've concluded to read out the names of those of you who really want me to, and stick with the previous version for everyone else. I hope that works for you. So, if you want to hear your full name here, and you are a patron or a one-time donor above £20, message me. And if you are not yet, well, you can sign up on patreon.com/historyofthegermans or on historyofthegermans.com/support, and your name will be heard of to eternity, or at least as long as there are podcast hosting platforms. And special thanks to Rory H.J., Simon W., Melissa G., Brad, and Barry M. Ah, and then just one more thing. As you know, I do not do advertising here on the History of the Germans. However, I occasionally highlight other history podcasters who make shows that I enjoy and that I believe you may enjoy as well. And one of these is the Cold War Conversations podcast by Ian Sanders. His show does exactly what it says in the title. He interviews people about the Cold War. And other than me, he is a gifted interviewer who gets his guests to truly open up. Sometimes about quite difficult subjects. He's talked to Stasi informants, East German soldiers, Mormon missionaries in Cottbus, a US soldier who defected to the GDR, various spies undertaking clandestine operations, but also just very regular people like Sabine, who was 13 when the wall came down. They're all sharing their experiences, some for the very first time. The Cold War Conversations podcast has a solid 300+ episodes under its belt, and some are grouped in playlists, including one on the former GDR. You can find it on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, and wherever you get your podcasts from, or on his website, coldwarconversations.com. But now, let us get going with the 13th century. Last week, we ended on Rudolf von Habsburg being elected King of the Romans and future emperor. But apart from some basic biographical markers, we haven't heard much about him. So, let's dig into his background. The gigantic Habsburg propaganda machine over the centuries had done its best to portray Rudolf as a poor count wearing a modest grey coat who rose up from humble beginnings to the crown, which can only have been down to divine providence rewarding his humility. Well, that is not quite true. Rudolf was born in 1218, the son of Albert, Albert the Wise of Habsburg. The Habsburgs were nobles based in the Aargau, which is today a region in the north of Switzerland. They were named after their ancestral castle, the Habichtsburg, or Castle of the Hawk, that still stands near the market town of Brugg. At the time, this was part of the Duchy of Swabia, and the Hohenstaufen had been the Dukes of Swabia. So as vassals of the Emperor, the early Habsburgs were involved in many of Frederick Barbarossa and Frederick II's campaigns. One ancestor had been at the fateful siege of Rome in 1167, when the Imperial army and with it all of Barbarossa's political capital vanished. That's episode 57, The Hand of God, if you're interested. During the civil war between Otto IV and Philip of Schwaben, the Habsburgs were backing up their Hohenstaufen side. And in 1212, Rudolf's grandfather made an audacious and ultimately extremely profitable move. He joined the young King Frederick of Sicily, who had come up to Germany on a desperate mission to oust his enemy, the Emperor Otto IV. And that endeavor, despite papal support, was by no means a guaranteed success. Only by a stroke of luck did Frederick get into the city of Constance on time. And Rudolf the Old, the grandfather of our Rudolf of Habsburg, was there by his side. And that was in episode 75, Wet Pants and Other Miracles. Now Rudolf's grandfather not only supported the future Emperor Frederick II with his sword and his advice, he also provided some much-needed funds. The Habsburgs contributed 1,000 marks of silver to the subsequent campaigns of Frederick II, more than the bishops of Worms and Mainz and the other four much more magnificent princes stumped up. So, not quite that poor a count after all. All these decades as loyal supporters of the House of Hohenstaufen had paid off quite handsomely. The family had been enfeoffed with various estates in the Alsace, the Black Forest and the Aargau. Other bits were added by the usual combination of matrimony and murder. But what made them really rich was a much more mundane source. The construction of a bridge across the Schellenen Gorge, which opened up the Gotthard Pass. This provided a new route for goods from northern Italy to come up north, and the Gotthard quickly became one of the busiest connections, and still is. The Habsburgs, by various means, controlled the whole section from where the road comes down into the valleys of Uri, Schwitz and Nidwalden to the Rhine at Bad Säckingen. The tolls on the bridges was what made the Habsburgs rich. Later, the Habsburgs will claim an even closer relationship with the Hohenstaufen, including asserting that Rudolf's grandmother was a certain Agnes von Staufen, and that Frederick II had stood godparent to Rudolf von Habsburg, all of which may or may not be true. Rudolf comes into his inheritance when he was 22 and his father Albert the Wise had died. Now, whilst his ancestors were mainly courtiers looking to progress by the generosity of their masters, Rudolf took a very different approach. In his time, there were no longer powerful emperors to cozy up to. This was the interregnum, and it was dog-eat-dog time. With imperial power waning, inheritances that in the past would have gone to the crown to be enfeoffed to another loyal vassal of the emperor were now divided up amongst their most aggressive relatives. And Rudolf was very good and very lucky at that game. He did benefit from the unusual fecundity of his family, which had placed sons and daughters into the bloodlines of, well, practically anyone who was anyone in southwest of the empire. Which meant that as other families less blessed with powerful loins expired, there's always a Habsburg claim in the mix. During his career as a serial heir, several important families were dying out or weakened. One was the lateral branch of the Habsburgs, whose possessions he managed to consolidate. Then a number of neighbors suffered from extinction. The Lenzburgs, then the Kyburgs, whose ancestor Werner von Kyburg was the friend of Ernst of Swabia from episode 23, and then finally the mighty Dukes of Zähringen disappeared from natural causes. Whenever that happened, Rudolf of Habsburg was there, holding the marriage contract in one hand and the sword in the other, demanding his share of the spoils, until he was the most powerful lord in the Duchy of Swabia. Now, this kind of life is one of perennial warfare. The Annals of Basel recorded that in 1268 he conquered Utzenberg and some other castles. In 1269 he takes Reichenstein. In 1270 he besieges the city of Basel for 3 days. In 1271 he burns down the monastery at Gronfelden and several villages. In that same year he also destroys the castle at Tiefenstein. In 1272 he goes after Freiburg and destroys the surroundings of the city, and so forth and so forth and so forth. When the negotiations over the election of 1273 drew to a close and Frederick of Nuremberg thought it expedient to bring Rudolf up to Frankfurt for the formal election, he he found him in the midst of a siege of the city of Basel, where he had conducted a feud against the bishop. Bishops were a sort of speciality of his. He made his name in a feud against the Bishop of Strasbourg, who had refused to hand over another one of these inheritances. His retaliation was relentless. He did not stop until he had the bishop stripped of all his strongholds and cities, including the city of Strasbourg itself. Once that bishop had expired and was replaced by a new one, his successor recognized Rudolf's victory. And all Rudolf asked for was his original demand. The cities and strongholds he handed back, allegedly without even asking for a ransom payment. So according to the chronicler, he did this to turn a foe into a friend and ally. And that kind of behavior was extremely unusual in the Middle Ages, and it hints to a more general observation that Rudolf was a strategic thinker well ahead of his time. Outwardly, he was warm and affable, but his engaging friendliness and outward humility covered a steely determination to win, and to win at all cost. Conventions of chivalry that ruled the behavior of Europe's elites to him were just that. Conventions, guidelines to be observed in normal times, but that could be bent or broken if the occasion demanded. The rules of feuding, as laid down by the Mainzer Landfrieden, he disregarded on several occasions, once by burning down a nunnery. It was for that he was excommunicated and had to do penance by fighting with the Teutonic Knights in Prussia. His favorite pastime beyond stabbing people was chess, a game in which he gained something of a reputation. And like any good chess player, he was able to think several moves ahead, apparently much further than his adversaries. The first move he made upon being elected was to reassure the electors that his days as an insatiable warrior, his own words, were now over. So shortly after his coronation, he addressed the princes, nobles, and people, saying, quote, "Today I forgive all those wrongs that have been done to me, release the prisoners who are suffering in my goals, and I promise from now on to be a defender of peace in the land, just as I was before a rapacious man of war." End quote. Now, we will see whether peace and justice were his main motivations to take the job, but he made the resurrection of the admittedly rickety, but only available, conflict resolution system, the Mainzer Landfrieden, the core of his political program. The Mainzer Landfrieden had determined that before any feud could be declared, parties were to consult a judge who would be given time to find a compromise. And there was a code of conduct to be observed. Breaking the code was to be sanctioned by the imperial ban. A banned man was ostracized, could no longer own property, and, well, could be killed by anyone passing by. The way Rudolf revived the old order was by appointing Landvögte, protectors of the land, each looking after a district, a bailiwick. There they were to resolve the disputes between the feuding parties and enforce the limitations set to feuding by the Mainzer Landfrieden. Now, whether this is successful or not, this is always hard to determine. But what we do know is that the system of the Landvögte remained for well after Rudolf's reign, and that their bailiwicks would later become the imperial circles. Now, though the Landvögte were usually members of the local aristocracy, they pursued the role of Vogt on behalf of the king, and therefore they had to be remunerated for this service. That remuneration was to come from two sources. One was a general tax, levied twice during Rudolf's 17-year reign. The other, and the more significant one, was to come from the imperial lands. But the imperial lands were all lost, weren't they? Well, yes, they had been, at least in large part. But it was the Landvogt's job to recover these lands, and this process was called the Revindication and formed Rudolf's second most important policy. It appeared that many of the lords and bishops recognized that the pendulum had swung too far away from central authority, and they were prepared to hand back at least some of the properties that had been lost. And so, one by one, towns and castles returned to the king. And that just showed the smart way Rudolf went about his program. By starting slowly and roping in the local lords as Vogts, he created acceptance for his policy. and once the policy was established, it developed its own dynamic. And the Forks demanded more restitutions that became more difficult to resist by the princes as the central authority became stronger. Peter Wilson has calculated that Rudolf's policy brought 66% of the imperial church fiefs back into royal control, 73% of the crown lands, and even 68% of the Hohenstaufen family possessions. And that is a truly remarkable success given that the family lands had been entirely lost. And just for the avoidance of doubt, the vast majority of these lands were in Franconia and Swabia. The north, that used to be the Stem Duchy of Saxony, remained distant from the king. Only 3% of all of Rudolf's charters ever relate to the north. The next thing that was needed was a flagship campaign that made it plain to see that times had changed and a new king was in charge. And that campaign was the cleaning out of the robber barons of the Rhine Valley. You may remember that the cities along the Rhine, Mainz, Worms, Cologne, Strasbourg, etc., had pooled their military forces and had tried to dislodge this menace to their trade in 1256, but that they had failed. Now in 1273, Rudolf von Habsburg gathers an army and joins up with the city forces, takes and burns Sunegg, and had the robber knights of Reichenstein hanged. Allegedly, he then used the wood from their gallows to build a chapel. In 1274, about a year and a half into his rule, he takes another step to reassert royal power. He calls an imperial diet in Nuremberg, where he requires all the imperial princes who hold their fiefs directly from the emperor to renew their vows of allegiance. That had been a standard procedure up until and including the Hohenstaufen. The feudal system in the empire perceived vassalage as a personal agreement between lord and vassal. Hence, if either lord or vassal dies, the successor has to renew the arrangement. Now, this ritual had, however, fallen into disuse during the ineffectual kings of the last two decades. So, in November 1274, all imperial princes gather, or at least send emissaries, who then renew the vows as required. By now, Rudolf had generously distributed the five of his six daughters to the various important princes, which made the whole thing also a bit of a family affair. Only one did not show, did not want a marriage alliance with Rudolf, and was impervious to his charm. And that was Ottokar II of Bohemia, the richest and the most powerful of the imperial princes. Ottokar had been a very strong contender for the crown, but had found himself outmaneuvered by the princes, by the Archbishop of Mainz, and by the Burgrave of Nuremberg, for which he bore a grudge against all of them. And he had a point, inasmuch as he was supposed to have been one of the seven electors, but at the last minute had been removed for some rather dubious reasons. Ottokar II did not only fail to show, he also made clear that he did not recognize Rudolf as a legitimate king. Instead, he began to style himself as an independent king. Though we need to remember that the title of King of Bohemia wasn't a real royal title. It was purely honorific, and other than a real king, Ottokar was the vassal of another king, and that king was Rudolf of Habsburg, the king of the Romans. Or at least, that is how things used to be. Ottokar II added the imperial eagle to his coat of arms, and he issued charters in the style of the imperial chancery, referring to himself as King by the grace of God. No way was he to bow down before that little count. So when Rudolf called the diet in Nuremberg, he must have known that Ottokar would not come. And he must have known that this would force a confrontation, and that this confrontation would be challenging, because of a minor delta in income and hence ability to raise troops. Rudolf's own lands produced about 7,000 marks of silver a year. The recovered imperial lands a further 8,000. Sounds like a lot, but you have to look at it in context. The Archbishop of Cologne, for instance, enjoyed an annual income of 50,000 marks of silver, roughly three times that of his king. But all that pales into complete insignificance in comparison with Ottokar. Ottokar isn't called the Golden King for nothing. His homeland of Bohemia had struck gold. Well, quite literally. The mines in the Ore Mountains were rammed full of mainly silver, but also copper and other valuable metals, whilst there were gold mines in Chilové just outside Prague. Ottokar kept about 200,000 marks of silver and 800 marks of gold in four heavily fortified castles. His annual income from Bohemia alone was another 100,000 marks of silver. And on top of that, he had the income from his acquired duchies of Austria, Styria and Carinthia, as well as the adjacent lands in northwest Italy and Slovenia, which might have been another 100,000 marks of silver. No way that the little Habsburg count could ever successfully stand up or even attack King Ottokar II, the golden king in all his pomp and splendor. Or so Ottokar thought. And Rudolf probably knew that Ottokar would think that way, and that was exactly why he staged that event at Nuremberg and why he had demanded Ottokar to come and to swear allegiance. Rudolf could not be an effective king with the Bohemians sniping from the sidelines, and how long would Ottokar be content with just sniping, and when would he stage his own election and try to oust him? The conflict was inevitable, and the only way Rudolf could win the conflict was if he gets the imperial princes to line up behind him. And that is not easy. The imperial princes may not like Ottokar very much, but that is not the same as going out to fight him. Rudolf needed to create an incident that triggered them into action. Ottokar's refusal to bow to him was that incident. Because it wasn't just an insult to him, but also an insult to all the other imperial princes who had elected him and supported him. It was the honor of the empire at stake, Barbarossa's old war cry. And there's another dimension. When I talked about the borders of the empire two episodes ago, I pointed out that whilst empire is universal and comprises in principle all of Christendom, it also had an inner core which comprises those territories that accept the emperor as their direct overlord. The kings of Poland and Hungary, for example, no longer did that, which made them now independent kingdoms and no longer part of the empire. Therefore, if Ottokar declared himself as a king by the grace of God, he thereby also declared his and his kingdom's exit from the empire. And that was not acceptable, not to King Rudolf and not to the princes. Rudolf had his incident, and the incident had created the support he needed. So he mustered his armies, both secular and spiritual. The Archbishop of Mainz kindly excommunicated Ottokar and issued an interdict that brought religious worship there to a standstill, which was a catastrophe in the eyes of the general population. An imperial diet declared Ottokar's acquisition of Austria, Styria and Carinthia illegal. The Duchy of Austria had been ruled by the House of Babenberg since the 10th century, and when the last Babenberger Duke, Frederick the Quarrelsome, had died, a prolonged war of succession ensued that involved the King of Bohemia, the Austrian nobles and the nieces and sisters of the dead duke. That war ended when Ottokar had gained the support of the Austrian nobles and had married the sister of the last duke. Whether that gave him a legal right to the duchy is at least disputed, and almost certainly disappeared entirely when he divorced the much older woman that he had snatched from a monastery in the first place. So when the imperial diet declared Ottokar's rule in Austria unlawful, they had good arguments. But that did not make it any less of a political decision. And they not only called in the fiefs, they went one further and they placed Ottokar under the imperial ban, making him an outlaw. So Ottokar II is now excommunicated and banned, which isn't comfortable for anyone. But even more uncomfortable must have been the realization that he has been outmaneuvered by the little count, and then he gets outmaneuvered one more time. Ottokar had expected Rudolf to come for him personally in Prague, and that is where he concentrated his forces. But Rudolf did not. Rudolf went instead to the barely defended Vienna and within a shortest time cleared the duchies from Ottokar's supporters. Ottokar found himself unable to retaliate. His people did not like the interdict placed on them by the Archbishop of Mainz. Rumors were going round the Pope was to confirm the excommunication, that Ottokar had put his daughter away into a nunnery to stop her from marrying Rudolf's son, that a hermit had seen a sphinx who predicted his immediate defeat, etc., etc. Ah, and there's the fact that whilst abroad everybody called him the Golden King, back home in Bohemia they called him the Iron King for his tyrannical rule. These hundreds of marks of silver had to come from somewhere, and best guess, it were the aching backs of the miners and the peasants that delivered it. Facing rebellion, Ottokar II gave up. He came to Rudolf to swear his allegiance. This image of the bejeweled Golden King in all his pomp and splendor, having to bow to Rudolf von Habsburg, who had chosen his most humble coat for contrast, been retold and reproduced infinite times. As was Rudolf's comment, quote, "Often has he mocked my simple grey coat, let him mock it now," end quote. Such humiliation cried out for revenge. No way is Ottokar the Golden King, the crusading hero of Prussia, going to let this stand. There will have to be a second round, and that second round came quite quickly, merely a year and a half later, in the summer of 1278. Now this time, Ottokar played his political cards a lot better. The key to Rudolf's previous success had been the imperial princes. So if Ottokar could just split them away from Rudolf, his chances would improve immeasurably. That wasn't particularly easy since Rudolf had formed a number of alliances with the main imperial princely houses, backed up by marriages to five of his six daughters. On the other hand, Rudolf's revindication policy started to discomfort some powerful people who saw rights and lands being brought back under royal control. And then there was the issue about Austria and the other duchies. Now the princes were all for taking them away from Ottokar, but that did not mean that they wanted it all to go to the Habsburgs. And where the princes would draw a firm line in the sand would be if Rudolf would take over the rest of Ottokar's kingdom, Bohemia. If that happened, Rudolf would be as powerful as Ottokar had been in 1273, and the whole point of electing Rudolf was not to have a powerful Bohemian king in charge. Playing on these cracks in Rudolf's alliances, Oscar ensured that the rematch would take place without the imperial princes. So that was a huge improvement to last time, but the flip side was that Rudolf was now not just a lot, but an awful lot richer. Austria had added a cool 100,000 marks of silver annually to his previous income of 15,000, not quite as much as the King of Bohemia could raise, but a lot more balanced than last time. And as the two sides worked their way to the decisive battle, Rudolf managed to find a new ally, the King of Hungary. Ottokar had been in conflict with Hungary, well, for most of his reign, and for the Hungarians, supporting Rudolf was a bit of a no-brainer. Ottokar made his first move on July 20th, 1278, and he invaded Austria. Rudolf led his troops out of Vienna to confront him. However, his army was not yet fully assembled. The soldiers he had recruited in Alsace and in the Aargau had to come a long way. The Hungarian allies, too, were delayed. All in, it took 3 weeks before Rudolf's army could march on Ottokar's position. Ottokar had chosen the terrain. A large plain outside the market town of Dürnkrut, about 50 kilometers northeast from Vienna. He had chosen his position well. The battlefield was bordered on its eastern flank by the river Marne and on the western side by some hills, forcing the battle to take place in the center. Rudolf had a slight numerical advantage, but a large part of his army was infantry and lightly armored Hungarians. They were less effective in a heavy cavalry battle where two blocks of armored knights crash into each other. So, Ottokar may be a touch more confident, but both kings knew that the outcome of a medieval battle was highly unpredictable and that the risk was not just political and military, but intensely personal. Both were experienced warriors, veterans of dozens of battles, and their men expected them to lead from the front. On the morning of August 26, 1278, the two sides, separated by a small stretch of water, were trading insults and chants, not dissimilar to the crowds at a football match. The Bohemians' war cry was "Praha, Praha," and was countered by Rudolf's army replying "Roma, Roma," and "Christ, Christ." There was a lot of rattling of shields and singing of songs as the knights mounted their steeds to form their line of attack. Rudolf's Flemish slingers hurled their stones at the Bohemians, whose cumans and sarmachins responded with clouds of arrows. But the impatient knights weren't prepared to leave the fighting to the great unwashed infantrymen. After barely a few minutes, the armored cavalry troops crashed into each other, and from then onwards, the slingers, archers, and bowmen could no longer distinguish between friend and foe and retreated to the grassy banks of the river to watch the spectacle unfold. They were fortunate that the great nobles hadn't decided to just steamroll them under their horses, as the French famously did at Poitiers. What followed was a typical battle during the times of high chivalry. It was man against man, and the two leaders easily identifiable, one by his crowned helmet and the Red Lion of Habsburg, and the other, clad in the most splendid armor and flying St. Wenceslaus' flaming eagle, were found in the center of the melee. Knights on both sides vied for the opportunity to unseat the enemy king. Several knights got close to Rudolf, but he fought them off, piercing one under the helmet with his lance. Then a gigantic Thuringian knight pushed his way to the king's side and speared his horse in the shoulder. Rudolf fell to the ground. Now, contrary to the general trope, medieval armor wasn't too heavy for a man to stand up again, even a 60-year-old fighter like Rudolf. But still, he was on the ground in the midst of fighting men on enormous horses and with his enemy in pursuit. His rescue came in the form of an Austrian knight who had seen him fall and charge his adversary and pulled his master up onto another horse. Soon after Rudolf had fallen and recovered, the battle was decided. And it was decided, as ever so often with Rudolf of Habsburg, not by fair contest within the rules of chivalry, but by cunningly bending them. The chivalric code demanded that combatants fight fair and square. No hidden reserves in the woods or sudden flank attacks. That would have been dishonorable. But Rudolf wasn't a chivalric knight, but a wildly ambitious Swabian chess player who cared more about winning than about honor. He had kept a sizable contingent of knights in reserve behind one of the hills. On his command, these knights appeared and charged the Bohemians, who were now static and caught in fighting their opponents. The momentum of the assault broke the Bohemian line, and they fled. King Ottokar, who had been fighting on the front line, was suddenly confronted by some of his personal enemies, men whose family he had executed. And these men did not do what would normally have happened at this stage, i.e. they would have taken the king hostage and demanded a truly epically large ransom. No, these men wanted revenge, and they killed King Ottokar II, the great golden king of Bohemia, the crusader in Prussia, and the dominant figure of European politics for decades. Ottokar was stripped of his rich armor, and his body was left naked on the battlefield. Rudolf had the body eviscerated to prevent putrefaction and then displayed in Vienna for 6 months to make sure no false Ottokars appeared. Only after that was his body brought to Prague and buried in St. Vitus's Cathedral, where he still lies. Rudolf used the victory to confirm the Habsburg rule of Austria, but he did not take over Bohemia. Bohemia was left to Ottokar's son, Wenceslaus, who married Rudolf's last available daughter, and again turning a foe into a friend. The little count had prevailed, and he can now move on to his next ambition, the imperial crown. How this pans out, we'll find out next week, and I hope you will join us again.